This second talk that we're going to do, that I've been asked to do, it's on the fossils and the rocks. And with that in mind, I've brought, courtesy of United Airlines, I've brought some rocks and fossils with me. You might, some of you, think that I'm one of them. But these, I assure you I'm not. And these are the rocks that I brought. I actually have a lot more at home. So when we break again, I'm not quite sure, are we sort of breaking for another proper meal or not? Or is that the end of it? Okay. But do come and have a look at the fossils at the end. And can I just mention that there is books there at the back, and I need to take those books with me by about 1:30, I think it's 1:30, the person who's going to drive me to the next meeting is going to collect me. So can you please look at the books fairly promptly afterwards? You'll see that there's a whole set of DVDs. Could somebody just grab one or two of them so that can just be just advertised now? Just one or two, just, and look back there, you'll see that there is a, okay, yeah. These DVDs are there, just in their sleeves. Those are $5, right? Including a DVD of this talk, which is Creation or Evolution, Looking at the Evidence. Thank you very much. Then there's my own book there, Genesis for Today, which is going for $10. Then there's another book of mine called Genesis 1 to 11, which is a thinner book, which was selling for $5. And it's quite cheap at the price. My new book, Genesis 1 to 11, then, is $5. And then there's, Kurt's holding them up now. Maybe he's just going to grab them, but whatever. He's going to buy them all up anyway. But thank you ever so much, boss. But this is the book which you've seen before, but yeah. You haven't seen this one. So Genesis 1 to 11 is a commentary, as you can see, on the first 11 chapters. Thank you. And the 1 to 11 one is $5 because it's quite thin. It's not meant to be a long read. It's really just to guide people. And these each are $5. We haven't got many of these left. But we've got a whole stack of the atheism ones because we obviously intended to promote that at the debates. Maybe we didn't really have that opportunity that we really wanted. But what you could do is each of you take a couple and use them to give out to people you meet on an aeroplane, on a public transport somewhere, you know, or just open airs that apparently you do at Balboa Park, is it? So you might think of, you know, using them for that. And then there is one or two other ones like this one, What is Science? There's one, I'm not sure whether we've still got one on dinosaurs there, but there are a few of the small booklets there. Not many left now because they've been going like hotcakes, actually, at the other meetings. So we're towards the end of this week of meetings, so they've all gone. There was another big book, which I'm afraid we only had 10 copies of, but they all went on one night. It's a big coffee table book with lots of photographs in, which is written by myself and Stuart Burgess, and you can order it, and it's called Wonders of Creation, Design in a Fallen World. And you can order it from day one, and they might be prepared to give you a discount if you order a few, perhaps for the church. That's just a thought, because it is actually produced very well. And it's good for sort of encouraging conversation. There's a whole page, double page on the bombardier beetle. There's a double page on the wonder of hearing. There's a double page on elephants. There's a double page on giraffes. Double page on virtually all, every creature you can think of. Obviously not every single creature. But Stuart Burgess is a very good writer. And I guess I'm just there to assist, but there we go. You might like it. And I've also done a whole section on fossils, which leads me into this talk, which is Creation or Evolution, Looking at the Evidence. Fossils, how do we understand them? How do we understand the rocks? What about radioactive dating? These are the sorts of issues that we will be looking at. And basically, we need to remember something. And I was at pains to say this to the Telugu Fellowship last night, that the battle is not the Bible against science. Some of you have heard this said repeatedly in the past, but it has to be repeated because we can slip into thinking that the other guys have science and we don't. It's not true. We both have the rocks. We both have eyes to look at them and other means of testing these and looking at them and examining them. But we come to different conclusions. That means the interpretations are different. Not that the science is different. The scientific facts of rocks and fossils is that they are there, but how you interpret them is different. So the argument is not the Bible versus science. It's evolution versus the Bible. Bible versus evolution. And the science is not the issue. It's the interpretation of the science. In Mount Everest, there are sediments. When you actually go a little, zoom in, you can actually see that there are layers of sediments on Mount Everest. And yet, they contain sea creatures in those sediments. How did they get there? Well, one option is to say that there was millions of years ago, there was some local flood, and that gradually this mountain, along with all the other Himalayas, has got pushed up, and there's been erosion as well. However, that doesn't really quite fit, as we shall see, because you've got fossils also in the lower parts of Everest as well. And all the fossils indicate that they were buried, we shall see as we develop this, fast. So actually, this is really evidence of the flood. The flood didn't cover Mount Everest. No, we're not saying that. The flood covered sediments, which then got pushed up after the flood, and while it was still soft, was actually being folded. The mountains of the Himalayas show huge evidence of folding. And yes, there's been erosion and other stuff, and now hardened, but there they are sitting at 6 miles above sea level. But they weren't originally. All the landmass was below the oceans. So the flood covered the world, as it says in 2 Peter 3, that then was. Let's now, in our discussions on this, consider some major principles, which are, how do we interpret the rocks? So how are we going to look at these rocks? Well, what I'm going to do first is look at some creatures that we do have today. For instance, let's look at a giraffe. And a giraffe, we can talk about, has wonderful special muscles to stop it just keeling over and losing the blood coming into its head when it next goes for a drink and lifts its head. It has special muscles to let the blood come to its head and do the reverse when it drops its head, because if it didn't do the reverse, then when it dropped its head and it didn't have special muscles to actually restrict the blood flow to its head, it would suffer a brain hemorrhage because it has a very big heart to drive the blood around that tall creature. And if it was to droop its head without some control, then there would be a brain hemorrhage and the giraffe would keel over again for another reason. So everything is telling you that giraffes actually are wonderfully designed creatures. And that, by the way, is in the book that I mentioned earlier. My point, though, is that when you look at the fossils, you find giraffes, recognisable as giraffes. Their heads are rather big, so they were giant giraffes in the past. And when we consider the geological column, now don't get too hung up by this, because it will mention millions of years, but I'm going to address that in the second part of this address today, I'm going to address that issue of dating. But even if we were to accept a millions of years scenario, you've got the situation that giraffes, which sit roughly in that location in the fossil record, which is, this is the tertiary, right? The quaternary, as you'd expect, means the fourth period, but then the secondary and the primary have got split up into these other layers. So it basically goes Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, and so on. And you'll have heard of these ones, Jurassic. Jurassic Park, of course, was a major Spielberg film talking about this supposed period of the dinosaurs. And the Cretaceous Age is, in the evolutionist mind, when they were all wiped out, right? So giraffes are much later in their thinking and nearer the top of the geological column. You never actually find the whole geological column in one location. But it is true, you do find the layers in that sort of order, but not always. There are major exceptions. The point I just wanted to get over to you is that giraffes have remained the same. There is no evidence of any development. The giraffe fossils look like giraffes we have today. We could talk about other creatures that you find in the fossil record. You sometimes find, for instance, butterflies. And a butterfly today, we observe, we see its migration patterns, we see the delicacy of the wings. But then if you go to New York State, Albany State Capitol Museum, you'll find it was until recently, I think it may still be there, in the main lobby as you go in, you see this wonderful example of a butterfly fossil. But that butterfly fossil, and it looks like a metal butterfly from what we can see, which we still have today, right, is no different essentially to butterflies we have today. Conclusion? Butterflies haven't changed much. And by the way, that raises an issue. How are you going to evolve a butterfly? A butterfly raises big issues. And if you ever want to use an example which will certainly make an evolutionist think, he will try to make an answer, but it basically he can't answer it. This is a good example. Why? Because if you're going to suggest that you evolve a two-body creature, which is what you have with butterflies, they start off as caterpillars, and in case you didn't realise it, caterpillars do not lay eggs, right? It's the butterfly that lays eggs. So if you're going to have some worm-like creature which is busy evolving into a caterpillar, it's not going to be good enough, is it? Because the caterpillar doesn't lay eggs. And yes, if you're evolving it into another worm-like creature which is laying eggs, you're not going to evolve it into a butterfly. So you are forced into the scenario, even if you do believe in evolution over gradual change over millions of years, you've got to have some sort of quantum leap at some point where this worm-like creature ceases to be the generator of its own body plan for the next generation. In other words, it cannot lay eggs anymore. And it generates a creature which is similar to what it was before, like a worm, right? But it's now not laying eggs for the next generation. It's actually saying, no, 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 you can't do that. You've got to have a second body plan to lay the eggs for this one. That's never going to work, is it? You cannot evolve a two-body plan from a single body plan without there being a complete change in the way that body is working in terms of regeneration, producing the next generation. If you hadn't understood that, go and read up on what's called metamorphosis. That means large body change. Meta, big, morphosis, change, okay? Large change. That's what is really impossible to show could have evolved. But my main point is this, that butterflies you find in the fossil record. There's no evidence of any change. Let's just move on to other insects that you find in the fossil record. For instance, you find fossilized dragonflies. And guess what? They look like dragonflies. So there's quite a lot here which is really saying there is no change, guys. And although there are some bigger versions, we might just play this video, which shows a dragonfly that we have today and a fossilized dragonfly. And even David Attenborough admits in this film that I'm just about to show you that really there is no difference. So remember I said that to actually develop a creature which undergoes a massive body change, such you've got two body plans, is exceedingly difficult to imagine how that could ever have happened. So you've got that problem, but you've also got the problem that that dragonflies don't actually look any different anyway when you see them fossilized. So let me show you this video of the dragonfly and we'll see how we get on. Whoops. Do it again. Still not doing it.
The river has also been the home of another kind of insect with an equally ancient ancestry, and it too is beginning to emerge from the water. Bigger and more ferocious than the mayfly larvae, it has been feeding on tadpoles and even small fish. But that phase of its life is over. Now each one has to haul itself out of the water and into the air. On the top of its thorax, it carries a bulging backpack. It hunches itself and its outer skin splits. A very different creature begins to appear. White threads are drawn out of its flanks. They are the linings of thin tubes that penetrate deep into its body, air tubes that will enable the insect to breathe now that it is out of water. It gulps air, inflating its body, forcing fluid into the bundle on its back. Its wings begin to unfurl. Ten minutes later, the wings open. They'll never close again. Next, the huge muscles within its thorax must be exercised to prepare them for action. And it's away. Dragonflies, like mayflies, belong to the most ancient group of insects that flew over the land. And here in the museum in Harvard, there are fossils of them that are 150 million years old. They're almost identical with fossils that are still flying today. However, they're by no means the oldest. We know that there were other dragonflies even earlier, 225 million years ago, that were flying through the coal measure swamps. We don't have complete specimens of any of those, but there are some tantalising and amazing fragments, and here's one. This marvellously preserved wing has very much the same pattern of veins supporting panels of membrane as living species. The thing that makes it different is its size. From base to tip, it measures 12 inches, 30 centimeters. Little imagination is needed to replace the membrane that must have been there. This insect must have had a wingspan as big as a seagull's.
So you get the point there that there is two issues, that the dragonfly fossils, he admitted, were the same, basically, as today. And there is another issue now being raised, which is, how do you get a fossilised dragonfly anyway? When a dragonfly dies at the end of a British summer, you will sometimes see dragonfly carcasses just with open wings. And they either become food for the birds immediately, or because they become so brittle and really just a shell within a day or so, they would, if you touch them, just simply go to dust. So how do you get that impression in the rocks? There's only one answer. They have to have been buried fast. Sorry to be gory, but actually, they've got to have been buried alive. And that is what the rocks actually show, that there is rapid burial of these creatures. And when we consider those dragonfly fossils, they are way down here. And this is now showing you that dragonflies have remained the same, but there's another message coming over here as well, which is that they were buried exceedingly fast. What's that suggesting? Well, I've got a book here which talks about a lot of sediment, a lot of water, or implies a lot of sediment, talks about a lot of water. Do you think it might be relevant? Well, of course it's relevant. This is why believing in the authority of the Bible, which is what we were speaking of in our first session, actually opens up an understanding of the science. And it gives you a framework. It doesn't answer every question, but it gives you a framework for understanding the science. And we need to come back to the Bible as our authority. By the way, just on the first talk, it was mentioned to me by two people, actually, that the Charlie Gard problem that we had, where sadly Charlie Gard was allowed to die in the end, and the life support machine was taken off, was all due to the issue of authority. It was a very good illustration. Thank you for telling me those two people. You're quite right to remind me of that, because in our country, a judge had taken it upon himself to decide what was right and wrong. Whereas in fact, the parental authority should have been respected and at least a chance given for that person to come over here and to have that possible treatment which might have saved the baby's life. But it just shows you that it's biblical authority again, which is the issue. Now, you might not have thought that the Bible would be that relevant to science, but it is. Not that it immediately gives you every single answer, but it gives you a framework for understanding how to look at the science. And we shouldn't laugh at the idea of a global flood, as many people do, but see that the evidence is actually consistent with it. How about this from Pennsylvania? Later Carboniferous rock, really, but it's way down in what the evolutionists will talk about as being 230, 240 million years old. And it is astonishing that in that shale they find ferns which are no different to modern ferns. But the second point that comes out from here is similar to the point I made about dragonflies and butterfly wings. This also is shown that it must have happened exceedingly fast. Why? Because if you take some plants for your beloved, you know, and you pick them in a lovely garden and you take them home, it's only within a day or two and they're going and completely lost it, haven't they? So if you were to uproot that vegetation of ferns, you wouldn't get that impression in the rocks. If you were to leave them there slowly smouldering or just lying, not smouldering, but just lying there, they'd just curl up and not make any impression on any bits of dust and mud which might have come on top. The only way you're going to get that impression is by burying freshly cut, freshly taken ferns. And that's what you'd expect in a worldwide flood. The violence of the vegetation being uprooted caused these fossils to be made. It's a beautiful sycamore leaf there, also found in Utah. So again, it shows that it was an instantaneous burial. Very, very rapid. How are you going to get a burial of an octopus where you can even see the suckers on the arms? Everything is telling you that that was buried exceedingly quickly, not slowly, but fast. Here's another octopus fossil, where again it's indicating rapid burial. But not only is there an indication of rapid burial, but it also shows you that even if you were to regard it as buried slowly, octopuses have remained the same. Now, we've done a few examples of that. We could actually do many more. But I just want to make the overall point that you find a whole raft of creatures, giraffes, butterflies, octopuses, and all the others there, which are the same as today, all the way through the geological column. The evolutionists will then come back to you and say, ah, but you just cherry-picked the fossils. How about those fossils of creatures that we don't have today? Which is a fair rejoinder to us. So we look at the extinct creatures like dinosaurs and trilobites. We know that dinosaur bones have been found in the rocks. This is an old film of people in the Dakotas, who were finding dinosaur bones, very large ones indeed. And we've found some large ones in our country as well. So we know that they existed. We're not Luddites denying the evidence of these creatures. It's true, we don't have dinosaurs today. So we're not saying that they are around today. Obviously, we are saying essentially that they are extinct. I'm having problems again with this thing. But I can never seem to get it to stay. It must be my head or something. Doesn't like English people. It's built for Americans. Right, okay. I'm not going to say anything about the size of people's heads. I'm the big head, probably. But this is dinosaur footprints, which we're not going to deny, are showing that there really were dinosaurs, large creatures, not all dinosaurs were large, but certainly some of them were, which were roaming the world in the past. We find evidence of them even in high mountains. I went to Peru visiting a person I know there and did some meetings out there, and he took me to a location way out in the mountains where you could actually see a whole set of dinosaur tracks in the mountains of Peru, just in the middle of nowhere. It's really staggering. You can go to Utah and find lots of examples of dinosaur footprints. So we know that they existed. So how then do we deal with those evidences? Dinosaurs, we know, are found generally in these types of rocks in the middle of the geological column. And trilobites, well, they are other creatures which are extinct again. This is, I'm going to pass around, this is a trilobite and this is another trilobite. They're mainly found in North Africa. That's where they tend to reside today. So please pass that round. Thank you. And there's another trilobite here. He's a bit of a sad case because he was lying over his friend and both of them died together, obviously, because you can see the impression of another trilobite there. But if you're an evolutionist, you've got to be respectful to these because these are meant to be your great, 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 and so on, uncle. Or it might be your great, 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 great aunt and so on, but we don't know. But you see, there is a... sorry to just be a little bit naughty there, but the evolutionist really does believe that all life is connected in one great big tree, including us. I don't believe that for a moment. But what I want to show you now is that when it comes to the fossils of creatures we don't have today, we can still say something from what we observe. Number one, these fossils were not made slowly. They were made fast. Just to really ram this point home, I'm going to pass around quite a few other fossils which are not of trilobites. Some of them, one of them is, but they're of other creatures we do have today, so it's similar to the first point. But basically, I'm showing you that all the fossils show evidence of being buried quickly. These are a couple of shrimps. Please be careful with that one. I don't want that to drop and shatter because it's quite valuable. This is one of a fish from Wyoming, and you can even see the scales of the fish there. This is a copy, it's not the original, of a fossil dragonfly, which is very, very clear. You can see the wings. And this is another trilobite here from North Africa. So I'll have those passed round. So what then do we learn about the fossil, in first of all, of a trilobite? Well, the real interest in trilobites is in their eyes. The eyes of trilobites are multi-lensed, compound eyes, a bit like the eye of the fly that you swatted the other day. Okay? That eye is made of hundreds, sometimes thousands, of individual lenses. But the great fact of trilobites is that those eyes are not made of protein. Those lenses are not made from protein. They are made from calcite. They are made of mineral. The lenses, therefore, have generally, not always, but generally been preserved. And if you put this lump of calcite, which I'm going to pass round, over a line which is underneath, so please pass this round as it is, you will see that naturally formed calcite does not produce an image which is clear. It's got two images. It's what we call a birefringent material. That's the close-up of the eye of a trilobite. And the crystal that I'm just passing round naturally forms two images. Does that mean that trilobites were going around squinting? No. Were they actually not seeing clearly? No, because each lens can be taken and put in a laboratory, and you can test with a laser what each one of those lenses of the trilobite was actually doing with light. And people have done that, and they found to their astonishment that the trilobite lenses are shaped in order to counter the double image effect. Let me explain how this is done. With any lump of calcite, it's a complicated effect, but there is two parts to light. There is light in one plane, and there's a light in the plane at right angles. Maxwell, who was a Christian, who predicted the speed of light, was the first one to understand the nature of light, that light is made of two planes. You talk about Polaroid lenses, which block out one part of the light. That's what you do. So light comes in two planes. Therefore, most of the time, you're not aware of this effect, but there is some material where the light in one plane is bent at one angle and the light in the other plane at right angles is bent at a different angle. That's why you have this birefringent effect. It's birefringent material. It's bending the light in a different way depending which plane of light you're referring to. It gets complicated. But how did trilobites have their eyes see just one image and not two? The amazing truth is this, that there is one special axis and only one in when you look down that line, such that the two images come together. It's not in, it's not an obvious line, but it is. This is the two planes of light getting bent at two different angles. So if you look at that cross at the top, and if you were to actually look down it carefully, though you'd find that there's one angle of elevation and one angle of rotation where you get those two images coming back together again. And the centre line of each one of the lenses of a trilobite eye, the centre line is lined up exactly down that very axis, which is astonishing. You've got brilliant optical engineering going on here. Trilobites were not simple creatures. They're found, as even the evolutionist terms it, in the Cambrian explosion of life, because he's got no way of explaining where on earth these creatures came from. They just suddenly appear. And of course, the answer is that they were there, created just like all other creatures, land creatures, sea creatures on day five, land creatures on day six. But at the time of the flood, they were buried very, very quickly. That's what's gone on. Let's now look at dinosaurs. Dinosaurs certainly existed. Whether they were always as fearsome as Steven Spielberg made out, we cannot be sure, but there certainly was evidence of feeding of dinosaurs on other creatures. Were they millions of years ago before man? No. They were made on day five and day six, just like all the other sea-going flying creatures on day five and the land creatures on day six. Now, not all dinosaurs are buried in this way, as illustrated on the screen, but there's a good number which are. I'll just take this example in Lohuaco in Spain, where eight different dinosaur species, including several kinds of armor-clad, plant-eating dinosaurs that were among the largest types, have been identified among 8,000 fossils found in 2007. And amongst them were prehistoric, they use the term, but I'm don't think we need to think of it as prehistory at all. But amongst them, the turtles and crocodiles were found as well. Well, what on earth were turtles and crocodiles doing buried with dinosaurs, land-based dinosaurs? There's only one answer. They were all buried together exceedingly quickly. So dinosaurs, far from being ancient, slowly changing creatures, are actually found with creatures we do have today, like turtles and crocodiles. Just to remind you here, then, well, we're basically saying that dinosaurs, we agree, became extinct. Although the evolutionists will say that it's due to some meteorite millions of years ago. What we're saying is, no, the dinosaurs don't show any evidence of being in existence millions of years before. All they do is that they show that they were buried with other creatures that we do have today, like crocodiles. Not a creature I want to get close to, particularly on a Saturday, but when I've got things to do, I don't particularly want to be chopped up by a crocodile. But the crocodiles that we find in the fossil record are no different to modern crocodiles, which is back to the first point. But in the same layers, you find dinosaurs. So the argument's pretty weak that dinosaurs were changing into birds, as what some evolutionists teach. Whereas other creatures like crocodiles were busy saying, no, thank you, I'm staying as I am for the next few million years. That argument is very weak, isn't it, for saying that the emphasis of evolution or the burden of evolution lies in some creatures changing and others basically staying the same. There are some interesting examples of dinosaurs where they're buried with turtles, actually in the same fossil. That is really indicating that there was no evolution going on. It was rather the loss of certain creatures because they didn't survive the worldwide flood. So let me now come on in my last section just to talk about the rocks head on and their dating. Because some of you might be thinking, well, it's all very well, Andy, I see your point that there are some creatures we have today and there are some creatures we don't have today. And that really the ones that we don't have today, like trilobites and dinosaurs, weren't really showing any evidence of evolution. They were buried fast and didn't survive the flood. That's a fair argument. But then the argument comes back, particularly from a Christian who has got sucked into evolutionary thinking. And often it's the vehemence is coming from them, much more than the secularist. Right? They will say, but we believe that the rocks are millions of years old. You may be right, Andy, about them being buried in a worldwide flood or buried in some sort of flood, and that it isn't evidence of evolution of these creatures. But please keep the millions of years. Don't let that go. We'll be called Luddites if we don't believe that. But guys, we've got to lose it. The evidence is indicating that the Bible is right on its timescale, and I'll show you why. How old are the rocks? Let's just look at dating. First of all, let's look at the coal layers. Coal layers are found big time here in America, particularly when you go to the eastern states, Pennsylvania and Utah, many other places, also in the north, in the Rocky Mountains, in Alberta, in Canada, huge British Columbian coal fields as well, massive coal fields. Coal found in Europe, England, right through to Germany, Poland, Silesia, then go further east to Asia. Coal is found in Australia, as indicated here, coal in New Zealand, coal in Antarctica. The very fact that there is coal found is very significant because coal is basically plant material. Well, I have a book here, did I say that? Which mentions a lot of water and a lot of sediment by implication. Do you think it might be relevant? Of course it's relevant. The very fact that you have massive coal fields going all the way across huge areas, vast areas. Here's the illustration in Australia where this particular coal field down near Melbourne and Victoria is half a mile thick and offshore increases to 3 miles thick. That is strongly indicative of massive burial. How do you get coal slowly? David Attenborough referred to the coal swamps. But a swamp doesn't produce hard coal. It might produce peat, like the Irish have in Ireland. But you won't get anything like coal just by leaving it out into the open and wet, damp, muddy vegetation might produce peat, but it won't produce coal. How do you get coal? The only way you can get hard, high-ranking coal is to bury it fast to stop the air getting in, because as soon as the air gets in, it combines with the carbon and it very quickly reduces what we call the rank of the coal. That is the percentage of carbon per kilogram of the material that you're digging up. High rank coal is strongly indicative in its own right, apart from fossils, it's indicative that it was buried rapidly. So the origin of coal is a very strong indicator that you've got massive burial going on. Some places you find coal fields and forests buried under coal fields. So one illustration of this is in Illinois, where ancient trees are recorded in the mines underneath in great big caverns not far from Chicago. It's very, very indicative, again, of rapid burial. But there's another reason why we can see that the rocks are consistent not only with rapid burial, but also not very long time ago, and that's this. If you're actually going to date the rocks, you've got to use a radioactive decay system in order to date them. But that is not a reliable method. We call it radioisotope dating, where it's a bit like a sand clock where the sand is going through the hole, and if you know what the rate of change of the sand going through the hole, you might be able to deduce how long that sand clock had been going. But you could be terribly wrong, because you don't know what the starting condition was. You don't know whether the starting condition was with all the sand in the top. It could have been that half of the sand was in the top. So you don't know when that clock, as it were, was starting. You don't know how to calibrate the clock. You also don't know that there couldn't have been other factors along the way which might have changed the way that went on. Let me explain this by using the illustration of the sand clock again, and by summarizing the three issues which are involved with radioactive dating. It gets complicated, but I don't apologize for that, because actually some of this debate is to do with detail, which has huge implications if you get it wrong. The original ratios of parent to daughter element, which of course the sand clock is a picture of, is not known. You don't know how much of potassium 40 percentage wise was in the rock before it changed to argon 40. Or you don't know how much rubidium was in the rock compared with strontium, which is the daughter element. It could be a whole host of different schemes here. You don't know the rate of decay, whether that was conserved. You also don't know whether there wasn't some additional material being added or taken away. So you see here that there are massive problems of assumptions in the way that we look at the fossils. Let me now just mention one system in particular, or at least I will just come up to mentioning it. I haven't quite got to that point. But I'm going to mention another scheme, which isn't potassium going to argon. It isn't rubidium going to strontium. It's another scheme where the decay is exceedingly fast. And that scheme, of course, is carbon 14 going to nitrogen. When carbon 14 goes to nitrogen, it decays to half its original value in 5,700 years. So in 10 of those amounts of time, you will have halved 10 times. Let me repeat that, because not all of you will have followed that little argument. Carbon 14 going to nitrogen decays much more quickly than potassium 40 changing to argon, which is the half-life of that will be measured in millions of years, right? But this is a fast scheme. So in 5,700 years, which seems still quite a long time to us, but believe me, that's a blink of an eye in secular geological times thinking, right? So, and don't get worried about the fact that it's not biblical. I'm coming to that. Just see that 5,700 years is not millions, right? Okay, you with me? Now, 5,700 years, you reduce it to half its original value. Then another 5,700 years goes by and you reduce it to half, under half, or half times a half, which is, on a Saturday, hot afternoon in San Diego, a half times a half is? Right. Well done. Right? Now, if I go for another 5,700 years, I got a half times a half times a half, which is? 1/8. The number is getting smaller. Now, considering that number on the bottom, you're dividing by 2 each time. We've done it 3 times. If we divide by 2 10 times, that means we've gone through 10 half-lives, and 10 times 5,700 years on a hot Saturday afternoon in San Diego is 57,000 years. Come on now, you don't need a calculator for that, right? And if you divide it by 2 10 times, that means on the bottom you've got 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 10 times, 2 to the power 10. Any computer whiskers here? Sorry? 1024. And I'd expect Johnny to get that immediately because he works at Qualcomm, which is pretty... There we go. So now look, roughly 1,000, okay? That's why we talk about it as 1K, which stands for 1,000. You know all that. My point is this, that 10 half-lives, 57,000 years for carbon-14, brings you to 1/1000th of what you had to begin with. That is tiny. If you really want to be sure, you could go to 20 half-lives, which will make it 114,000 years, and you'll have reduced it to 1/1000000th of what was there before. 1/1000 times 1/1000. But even 1/1000 is very, very small. There will be very little trace of any carbon-14 there, right? Now, here comes the punch. Having established that, guess what? Repeatedly in coal, carbon-14 is found. What's it doing there? It should all have gone. It's meant to be 240 million years. It ain't. It must be less than 57,000 years as a maximum. Or if you really want to be doubly sure, could say 100,000 years. But really, it's so much less than millions that you're arguing over small amounts in geological circles. They are saying, oh, there must be some sort of something wrong in these experiments. You've got some, you've got some stuff which has come in, which you've picked up, and it's messing up the experiments. But actually, this is happening repeatedly. What is fascinating here is that carbon-14 has been found, amazingly, in dinosaur bones. Because carbon is in living systems. You've got carbon-14 in you. And sadly, when you die, the carbon-14 is gradually emitted from your remains, and after 57,000 years, there won't be any carbon-14 present, right? Now, I know we're not on to biblical timescales, but the point is, that's way less than way less than the millions of years that the evolutionists want. And this is repeatedly found and repeatedly denied by the evolutionists. But there is no answer to it. This means that the dinosaur bones are not 65 million years old. And that is just stunning. Now let me tell you something else about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are found with unfossilized meat in the marrow found in the fossilized femur bone. This was the first example found by Mary Schweitzer when she was in Montana. unfossilized meat, which a dog would have liked to gnaw on, and you could have had a T-Rex steak if you'd taken the marrow out and put it into the microwave. What's that saying? It ain't 65 million years old. That's what it's saying. It's of the order of thousands of years. Now, actually, all those issues about how much was there to begin with this time of carbon-14, remember that was an issue, what we were discussing. How do you know how much of the parent element was there? Because carbon-14 is produced by cosmic radiation bombarding or bringing in neutrons, which those neutrons in the nitrogen then turn into carbon-14. It's quite a process to produce carbon-14. But the amount of carbon-14 which may have been in the atmosphere in the past could well have been an awful lot less than what we have today. All the calculations for how long something has been or how old it is based on the carbon-14 content can only be done on the basis of assuming the amount of carbon-14 when the creature dies is similar to when I die or my grandmother died, you know, and the amount of carbon-14 in her body and my body is the same as what it would have been had I lived many generations ago. But that may not necessarily be the case. In fact, it's quite likely a lot less carbon-14 was in the atmosphere in the pre-flood world. In which case, the calculations which we had for the dinosaur bones, I don't know whether you saw it in that picture, but those dinosaur bones came out with levels which indicated ages of 25,000 years, 30,000 years, 29,000 years. All that collapses down to biblical timescales in a moment, once you say that there was less carbon-14 in the original atmosphere. This is very, very important evidence. So I end, friends, on this, that we don't know, obviously, all the exact details here. I'm not saying we do. In fact, I cannot say that every single fossil is from the flood, but a lot of them show big evidence that they were from the flood. Take the one of the fish that I showed earlier. There is also a case of a fish eating another fish. There's a case here of an ichthyosaur in the process of being on the hospital bed, you know, to producing another ichthyosaur. Then the midwife is just actually taking out the little ichthyosaur and bang! Or did she die in childbirth? I think it's the former, don't you? Catastrophe. And you may not like the cartoons, but it does just make a good point. The fish are enjoying themselves, suddenly buried, dead, right? Catastrophe. You don't like it. But the gory detail is, guys, all the evidence shows that 99% of the fossils were buried fast. Now, I will admit that some of the later ones could have been post-flood catastrophes. The mammoths, for instance, found in Siberia, still with food in their stomachs and the skin still on them, could be a post-flood. We don't know for sure. But a good number of all the other fossils, particularly coming into what we call the below the Cretaceous, but I would say most of the tertiary is flood. I put the flood boundary quite high up in my thinking, but people do disagree on that. But that's not a big issue, friends. What we're getting over is that the major big picture is that the fossilization is primarily from the flood. And the rocks are not millions of years old. And the fossils are not millions of years old. They are indicators that God really did judge the world in the past. Well, if the God judged the world in the past, does that mean that there is going to be a judgment in the future? Of course it does. And that is the message of the rocks, that just as there was a disaster in the past, God says in Luke chapter 17, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the day of the Son of Man. God says in 2 Peter chapter 3, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. I have a model of Noah's Ark here. Noah's Ark has been, a replica of it has been built in Kentucky. Well worth seeing. I went to see it with my wife and we were really impressed with the amount of work that had gone into the exhibits inside. And it's huge. The mere width of the Ark, let alone its length, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide. It's really is impressive. You're dealing there with something which is of a gigantic structure for that day. But people weren't primitive, as is made out by many people. Oh, they couldn't have built such a thing. No, they did know what they were doing. And it was built for stability. The world that then was being overflowed with water perished. So what's the message? Judgment. Just as there was a judgment by water in the past, today we are looking towards the day when there will be a judgment by fire in the future. Which brings us to the serious implications of the creation stroke flood position. That God is on the throne, his word cannot be broken, and he is the one who has the authority and will bring all men into judgment unless, what? They believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. So my dear friends, turn, if you haven't already, to Christ. The ark is a picture of Christ. There is a direct gospel connection between the flood, Noah's Ark, and Christ and his death on the cross. If you're not yet a believer, not yet believe that he died to take your sins personally on the cross, if you'd like to know more on that, please talk with Pastor Kurt or the elders here, or talk with me, others whom you know are believers. We'd love to lead you to an assurance of Christ as your Saviour. Thank you. Any questions, feel free to ask me, just for 5 minutes or so. Then I think we're going to finish at 12:30, or shortly after it. So, any questions? Yes. Do you know what they say? Mary Schweitzer wrote about this. She's now moved to another location. She's in North Carolina now, I think. But she says very seriously in one of her articles, well, this is amazing that meat can last this long. We hadn't realized. And that's what they're genuinely researching into. They think that there is some chemical in there which is making the meat last. I'm afraid that's what happens when you will not consider the obvious alternative.
And how long, generally, time period does it take for that meat?
Yeah, that's a very good point you've made, that if you heard what the lady said, how long does it take for the meat to deteriorate? Actually, you can measure that. It's really when our bodies die, we can measure roughly how long it takes for the disintegration of the proteins which our bodies are made of. And meat goes putrid, you know, even in a fridge it'll go putrid quite quickly. So you can measure this rate, and I haven't got all the facts at my fingertips on that, but it certainly isn't 65 million years.
Yeah.
So Bill Nye, did you say?
Bill Nye, yeah.
What does he say? Say again.
The rings of the trees.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, Bill Nye is pulling a fast one on us if he says that dendrochronology, which is basically the study of tree rings, can prove that we're millions of years old as a world. That's not true. In terms of one tree, and its tree rings. There is no tree older than the Canadian redwoods, which are possibly, I think it's of the order of a 2,000 years tree that they've got in Canadian redwoods. And as far as we know, there is nothing which will stop a Canadian redwood from growing. You know, there's no disease. They're so strong, right? And they are, that itself is consistent with the flood, which is of the order of 4,500 years ago. Actually, I think it's, I think if I'm right on this, that the Canadian redwoods are older than 2,000 years, that they are actually heading towards the age you'd expect to be after the flood. But the point of your question is, can you actually find examples where you could count the tree rings and it goes way beyond the biblical time period that we're given in the scripture? And you can't, not just on one tree, right? Now, they can argue, and this is the way they do it, they say, well, we've got all the tree rings here in this tree, and we think that we can now move to another tree, which we think has been there for a lot longer, but died out, right? So they then connect the tree rings here to another tree, and they've shifted the whole period to an older period, right? So they then begin to count those, it, really the tree rings that are alongside, but they're saying that they're shifted in time. And that's what they do. So there is, in other words, Bill Nye's got a lot of assumptions in what he's saying. You need to unpick it, as always is the problem with these statements. We came from Martians. Oh, that's an interesting one. Maybe we need to put him on the Mars thing and just let him go into space with all the rest here.
How do kangaroos get to Australia?
How did kangaroos, after the flood, presumably you mean, get back to Australia? I don't think that's a hugely difficult issue. We do find marsupials, by the way, not only in Australia. In the fossil record right at the top, there seems to be some evidence of them having been in South America as well. So not kangaroos necessarily, by the way, but other marsupials. So there is a bit of disagreement in the creation community. Some would say that some of these fossils are post-flood and could be evidence of radiation of the new creatures are immediately after the flood, that is spreading out in a migration pattern. I'm not so sure on that. I'm never quite sure whether they're flood or pre-flood, but let's just deal head on with your issue. How did they get there, wherever you find them? Okay. The creatures going out after the flood would go out at a much more rapid rate than people. People were congregating in the Middle East, and indeed, God was not pleased with them. He wanted them dispersed, but they tended to congregate in the plain of Shinar, and they built the Tower of Babel and all the rest. But the animals were going right out to wherever they could find food, right, very quickly. And after the flood, there was probably an ice age. Everything indicates that after the flood, which involved a lot of heat, a lot of ash going into the atmosphere, occluding the sun, recipe for one main ice age, possibly 100 or 200 years, mainly in the northern hemisphere, locking up the water with ice, lower sea levels. Therefore, Indonesia would connect not just by a series of islands, but actually by a landmass, okay? Also, Siberia would connect with Alaska. You might not enjoy it, but I'm afraid that's true. So it's a good job they're separated today, isn't it? But with Russia getting belligerent. But so in the past, that landmass connected. The only problem you have is right at the end of Indonesia, you come to what's called the Wallace Divide, where even if you've got a dropped sea level, you've still got quite a mass of water in between. But I don't think that's a massive problem, because there'd be a lot of vegetation, floating forests after the flood could have jammed and enabled some creatures to cross over into Australia. So one issue, of course, is that you find fossils of kangaroos as well as kangaroos there. So some of us have issues as to whether kangaroos fossilised are post-flood or whether you're sending creatures back to where they were fossilised before. That's something which hasn't been totally sorted out in the creation world. Yep. I'll come to you afterwards.
The illustration of the coal fields.
The what?
The coal fields in Australia.
Coal fields, yeah.
So they were on the east coast, and then it just looked like there was a concentration of that.
There is.
With the other continents, if you were to bring the pieces together, does it show them all?
Yeah. I have no problem with the continents coming together, continental drift on a much larger scale, not small scale, tectonic plate activity. Clearly, I think was going on. So America was connected with Europe, afraid so, guys. And the Atlantic was not there, right? And South Africa and, sorry, Africa and Europe connect into America and also with Australia. There would be what's originally... The original landmass is sometimes called Gondwana land by the secularists, okay? I have no particular problem with that. There possibly was one large landmass before the flood, but this was split open catastrophically by underground activity, volcanic activity, earthquake activity. It was a huge disaster that took place with water possibly from underground caverns, some of which you still have aquifers today under Australia, right? So that then would explain the way the plates are still unstable today, and there's still a propensity to earthquakes in certain parts of the world because of the breaking up of the plates in the past. Coming back to your point about coal, though, it does seem that there was a massive sort of tipping up in some way, such that all the vegetation slid down over a continent, down towards Tasmania and Melbourne, and massive coal fields. And you see the Cretaceous layers in New South Wales. I don't know if you've ever driven from Sydney up to Newcastle, but that road has been cut through towering cliffs of Cretaceous rock. And it really is very impressive. And that Cretaceous layer, if I may just add this, that Cretaceous layer is the same layer as you've got in Europe and is the same layer as you've got on the eastern seaboard of the United States, not as far back, far over as here, but almost all the way up to the Rockies. So it's a gigantic world layer, right? So many people think that the Cretaceous is a massive evidence of flood deposits. And some people, I would go a bit further than it, but some people would say that the Cretaceous is where the flood sort of comes to an end and the tertiary is post-flood. I actually would say it's a little bit higher than that. There's a question here. Thank you, Jenny. Sorry, I was so slow coming to you. Sorry.
No, my question was about that whole concept of Pangaea, I think is what
yeah.
we would call it.
It is possible.
As they are now, because they're still shifting.
That is possible, and thank you for that, Jenny. So Pangaea, or Gondwanaland, or whatever we're going to call it, could have actually, yes, separated at the flood, but not been as far apart in terms of the continents that we have today. So certainly I think that there's some evidence for what you're saying in that India is ramming itself against the Eurasian plate. And there, in Psalm 104, it talks about the waters going down and the mountains going up. The first part of Psalm 104 seems to be about creation. I think Kurt would probably agree. And then once you move on in Psalm 104, it talks about the waters not covering the world again. It seems to be a reference to the flood. And when you think about the mountains rising, that would mean that the Rocky Mountains rose after the flood with all the post-flood tectonic activity as the world settled down, which would fit in with what you're saying. And so the Alps were formed after the flood, the very high Himalayas, or Himalayas, or whatever we say. You know, you say it differently over here. There's a number of things. But, they're formed after the flood. And that would then suggest, as you've just said, that there was a lot of further tectonic activity going on immediately after the flood. So thank you. That could explain, as you say, that things were closer and the animals could get over there. Yeah. And it would also explain why there's evidence for post-flood fossilization, which I do accept, by the way. I used not to accept it, but I can see that the geologists who know more than I do, I'm not trained in this area, I'm just an amateur, but they say, look, we've got to accept that there is some room for post-flood fossilization, which would mean that there was local disasters going on as the world settled down. Should we leave it there, or do you want to? Oh, you one last question? Yeah. Can you speak up? Radioisotope dating is what you're referring to.
Yeah, so is there a more reliable method that Christians use?
We can't, because none of us were there. So we have to take the authority of the Bible as our guide, right? Now, I have been saying, though, that carbon-14 is a unique scheme because it... If you, even though you don't know what you're starting with, right, you still have the same problem as to getting the exact dates, because it gives you a maximum possible, which is 10 half-lives, or you could even say 20, for anything which has got carbon-14 in, it at least gives you, what's the word in mathematics? Upper boundary, that's what I was looking for. It gives you upper boundary for a possible maximum age of the rocks which have got carbon-14 in. So many people think that carbon-14 is a problem for creation people. It's our friend, right? So the one which is, I think, a very useful argument to use with evolutionists is... What about carbon-14? Why do we find it in the rocks? Why do we find it in dinosaur bones? Why do we repeatedly find it in fossilized wood? By the way, if you go down the Grand Canyon, I've had the privilege of doing that trip where you sort of sleep out in the open at night. Wow, it's wonderful. And sort of seeing all the wonderful beauty there. But as you go down the Grand Canyon, you can see places where there is fossilized wood caught in it, right? And people, when they look at that fossilized wood, they find carbon-14 in it. They even find carbon-14 in diamonds, right? Now, this is an argument that creation folk and Christians believing in the biblical account should use. So you're asking for, is there something that Christians could use? I would say that's the one to use. But it only gives you a maximum. It doesn't tell you the exact age, because we've still got the problem that you don't know how much of the parent element was there to begin with and the daughter element, which, of course, is nitrogen in that case. Yeah.
As far as Mount St.
Helens, yes.
How did they respond to that when you use some of these dating methods and come up with these several thousand or million years of this new rock?
They would just say that you've got... You haven't got pure examples of the rock. You've got some other stuff in there as well that has messed up the measurements. So you haven't got pure magma from the original volcano in which went off. But actually, what's most interesting is that Steve Austin went to the central core of Mount St. Helens, which is still... potentially could go off yet again, right? But went to that central core, took some magma, got it dated, they came out to be millions of years old. So, I mean, it's... That's right. They will just find an answer for everything. They basically are refusing to go where the evidence leads. But the Mount St. Helens explosion and the aftermath of it with the lava flow and the canyons formed, which look like mini versions of the Grand Canyon, is a real demonstration of the fact that in a very short space of time you could get totally, you know, you get layers laid down and canyons formed. And it all looks as though it might have been millions of years ago if you were to look at it, have not known the real history. But the Mount St. Helens history, we know what happened in 1980. Shall we leave it there? But thank you so much for your keen interest. And don't forget the books and the DVDs which are at the back. So please do have a look at them. You've got about...